Let's take our Bibles and turn to Esther chapter 6 this morning. Esther's chapter 6. This morning I'd like to look at the irony found in hanging gallows. And that word irony is a word that is used oftentimes. We use it with a little bit of a confusion about how it works. Sometimes we use the word, or we say something in sarcasm, and we act like that is the same as irony, where we say one thing and mean another. And I think in a sense, I guess that's a good way to think about irony. But I'll tell you, irony is a lot bigger than just sarcasm. It is when an expressed statement or an intention does not match an expected outcome. Irony is described in four different ways, I guess, as a literary device, whether it's verbal, situational, dramatic, or Socratic. And I'll explain to you what those look like and how they mean. But sometimes when you hear something and you have one expectation of what it's supposed to mean, and then you realize after the fact that it did not mean what you thought it meant. Brother Clifton, just a few moments ago, you spoke to me and told me, he said, I've already heard two great messages today. And you know it's the dot, dot, dot that goes right behind it. I've already heard two great messages today, and I could have left it there, but you know where my mind went? My mind went, his day is done. He's not going to hear any more great messages today because he's already heard his two for the day. And it struck me in my sense of pride. And I think that was the irony of the moment. He was just telling me that he's heard two great messages today. Whether it's a great message in these next few moments, I'm not going to look to you to decide that, because I know the one who says what is great. Let me explain to you what these four areas will look like, with the verbal, the situational, the dramatic, and the Socratic. Verbal would be a statement that is ironic, where one statement is said, but the outcome is different. The situational would be where you find yourself in a situation that the outcome wasn't the way it expected. Dramatic would be, well, as you can imagine, it would be the overall tension that's developed from the expected. I think when you look at verbal statement, they'd be a great way to think about it is famous last words. We're going to look at some of those. A situational irony is where you think you're going to be recognized or someone saying a compliment to you about someone else, and you mistake it that it's your compliment, and it gets embarrassing for you. We're going to see that in the chapter. We see the dramatic in the sense of the story, where the outcome is not headed in the same direction that you expect it to go, which is clearly Esther chapter 6. But Socratic irony is a device where you make a statement in order to bait someone into a conversation, in order to prove the error or the fallacies of their position or their opinion. You think that they're on your side, but really what they're trying to do is reveal the weakness, the flaws in your line of thinking. It's Socratic in the sense that it's a device that Socrates used in training his students. Well, let me explain to you now with a modern illustration of what irony looks like and how all four of these ironies will play out in a circumstance. I don't know if you can see the image very clearly, but I have a picture of a bull rider getting thrown off of a bull, and I've got two rodeo clowns in the image. I don't know if you can make that out very clearly. I can see them. I see one of the clowns has got his hand on the bull's horns, and the other one is standing at the back of the bull. Now, I want to ask you, just from the sense of irony, where is the smartest person in all of this picture? Is it the man standing in front of the bull with his hand on the horns? Is it the man who's getting thrown off of the bull rider, who's about to run and try to get out of the pen? Or is it the rodeo clown that's behind him that is the one who's the smarter, because he's not in the harm's way? I think if you can look at the background of the picture, there's an ambulance driver. in an ambulance, and he's actually the smartest person in the smartest place. He knows the outcome of this is not going to be very good. But let me demonstrate for you what verbal irony looks like. Have you ever heard someone say, "Watch what I learned to do"? Hey, watch this. Anytime you hear someone say that, you know that the outcome is probably not going to go the way they expected it. Whether it is through them trying to demonstrate some trick that they've learned or telling you some kind of a joke, the more I think about it, seems to be this is the pattern of my life. I'm constantly asking Melina, "Hey, let me show you something that I've learned to do." That is verbal, because I oftentimes demonstrate that I have not indeed learned it. It blows up in my face. Oftentimes, if I try to tell a joke, there is no laughter, and that's not what I learned. The joke was funny to me, and you laughing is what the expected outcome is, but I have learned that the expected outcome of my sense of humor is that people do not laugh, and that's when I know that it's truly funny to me, but not funny to you. Situational, in that sense of that picture, you've got the two rodeo clowns there in the picture. I remember as a young man growing up on a farm, and I had a cousin who came to visit and stay with us for the summer. He did not grow up on a farm. And do you know that just out of meanness sake, we told my cousin that if you sneak up behind the bull, you can pull his tail. And do you know what? If you sneak up behind a bull, you can pull a bull's tail. He will let you pull his tail. And then he will kick you to the ground, and he will turn and chase you. And that was great fun that we had that day when my cousin learned that you can sneak up behind a bull and pull his tail, but it does not end the way you think that it ends. A dramatic explanation is, you know what? That's not the what happened last time I did that. That's not the way it went for me last time as I was learning this. It didn't turn out that way. We think of the story of Romeo and Juliet, a tragedy, oftentimes thought of as a very romantic story, but it is not romantic in any form or fashion. As a matter of fact, it is two very immature, star-crossed lovers, to use Shakespeare's words, who are burning with passions. And the story ends very, very sadly and tragically. It's not a comedy. It doesn't have a happy ending. It ends very sadly. And we often think of that as a romance. And romance is waiting and following God's plans for your life. And the situation of the dramatic, it does lead to a change in the expected outcome. You think that a story of two people falling in love would be a story that's going to end happily. But sadly, Romeo and Juliet doesn't. The bull rider in the bullpen who is grabbing the bull's tail is going to find out that, you know what, just because you got away with it once, the expected outcome is the bull is going to turn on you. Now, for the Socratic irony, I'd like to look at this statement. This is where you pass off everything that you've learned to someone. Now you try. Maybe you will do better. Have you ever been with a group of people your age who do not know better? And I know I'm looking at a room of people your age. And I'm speaking to a group of people, and you'll have to remember back to those moments when you have someone who was a self-proclaimed expert on any given topic, or maybe it was just an activity that you were going to do together, and they want you to learn the hard way how not to do something. And they tell you, I don't know why it is when we're younger, we tend to listen to the person in the group who speaks with the most confidence. We think, oh, that's the person that I want to follow because they sound like they know what they're talking about. But oftentimes I find that if you've got a lot of pride, you can have a lot of confidence. And that false confidence and that false pride does not lead you to where you think it goes. As a matter of fact, oftentimes when moms and dads try to train up their children in the way that they should go, it requires them taking the training wheels off of the bicycle and watching the child fall off of the bicycle in order for the child to learn. Is you got to get back up on the bicycle and try it again. If you fall off the horse, get off the horse and try it again. So the Socratic method is really used to help train or help to expose a weakness of a situation. We've been talking about irony these last few moments, and it's when the outcome does not match the expectation. When we look at chapter 6 of Esther, and we see the irony of pride in Haman's life. As a matter of fact, I'd like to take you for a few moments to consider where it all started, the source of pride in this world. It was born in that statement, "I will be like the Most High God," in Isaiah chapter 14, verses 13 through 15. "For thou hast said in thine heart," this is Lucifer speaking, "I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit." Everything that Lucifer thought was exactly the opposite of his outcome. Cast down from heaven and brought to the lowest pits of hell. For Lucifer and his pride, he had to learn a lesson that you and I struggle with each and every day living in this fallen world. Every man, woman, boy, and girl ever born into this world struggles with learning this lesson that there is none greater than God. Isaiah 46:9, "Remember the former things of old, for I am God. There is none else. I am God, and there is none like me." Pride convinces us maybe that's not so. We begin to question God's word. As a matter of fact, we see Lucifer, Satan's skill at questioning the words of God. When he asks Eve in the garden, "Hath God really said that? You shall not surely die," in Genesis chapter 3, verses 4 through 6. So we look at Adam and Eve standing in the garden there next to the tree that has the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And they've been prohibited from eating of that fruit. And the devil uses and appeals to their sense of pride as he speaks. And he says in verse 4, he says unto the woman, "Ye shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. As the devil appeals to their sense of pride and intellect, he causes them to question what God has warned them about. And he offers to them the promise of sin that would make them to be more like God. They are to stay away from the tree, not eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And the devil admits what the outcome is. If you eat of this tree, you will know the difference between right and wrong. It's there in his statement. But Eve looks at it, and it's a tree that's to be desired. It's going to make her wise. It looks good. She eats and gives to her husband. And the promise, get this, the promise of sin to be more like God brings the presence of sin's reality that I know that I am unlike God. The promise of sin, that you can be like God if you will eat of this, brings with it the knowledge and the reality that I am unlike God because I have now done evil in his sight. I have done that which was wrong. And the price of having that knowledge, of doing wrong in order to have that wisdom of God that the devil promises, is the way sin works and that sin entices us and appeals to our sense of pride. We always think that the promise is better than the payout. We always think that it's going to be better for us because we know better, that someone maybe has failed in the past, but we're special, we're different, and we can do it a whole lot better because, after all, it's me. And I'm pretty good. I've had people tell me that I'm pretty good. People tell me that I'm amazing, and I believe it. Have you ever noticed this seems to be today that a lot of people, you don't even have to tell them they're amazing because they already know it. They're already convinced of how amazing they are. Do you know how I know that? Because they will tell you how amazing they are. I think to myself, wow, whatever happened to good old-fashioned humility? Whatever happened to good old-fashioned just not thinking so highly of yourself? Because in Esther chapter 6, the table is set for Haman, and his pride is going to catch up with him. And for us who are in this room right now in this moment, let me just say to you that when it comes to our pride, it produces the same outcome every time. And it's ironic to think otherwise. That this time it will be different. That this time I will come out on top. I want you to note that last week we saw Haman's wife encouraging him to build the gallows, and Haman's gallows have but one design flaw. That's next week. But this morning, here's our big idea. We're going to look at this and we'll be done. There is no honor in your pride. Would you join me in prayer as we go to the Lord and ask Him to bless our time in His Word? Lord Jesus, we come to You this moment and we ask that You would speak to us from Your Word. Lord, I pray that Your Holy Spirit would speak to our hearts and convict us of the need of humility. Lord, understand that our pride ends up the same way that it has ended up for every person who has sought to elevate, to promote themselves. Lord, may we surrender to You. Keep us humble. Make us abased when we're not, so that we can see You where You're at. We can see that You are working in our circumstances, and that we know, Lord, that You love us, that You care for us, and that You keep Your word. We ask these things in Your name. Amen. Last week, I brought a point to you that I'd also like to review about the importance of every moment counting. It was the concluding thought of the last week's message. Because we oftentimes think of life, or we try to divide life into those really, really big moments. And admittedly, most of us probably only have one or two really, really big moments in our life. I'll call them moments of greatness. Moments where we stepped up and we did something that was unusual or unexpected, ironic, I guess, in the sense, and we came out on top, or we were recognized for that big moment that we did. Maybe it was an act of bravery, an act of sacrifice. Maybe it was just an act of doing the right thing in the right moment, and it had big consequences in the course of your life. We talked about that being that moment that someone, that your husband, or when he asked you to marry you and you said yes. That's a big moment. And you got it right. And you see how that played out. Happily ever after, Mrs. Rouse? She smiles. My pride is diminishing right now as I stand here before you. As I think about, though, the reality of every moment counting, we need to stop and consider that it's not just a matter of importance that we get the big moments right, but rather every moment in our life has eternal consequences. And when we start to consider that our life has, yes, big decisions that have to be made, it's oftentimes the small little decisions that we make that lead to the biggest of consequences in our life. Shouldn't have eaten that whole bag of potato chips. It was just one, and the bag said you can't eat just one. And they're right. And if you eat a whole bag of chips and your iron, your stomach's not made of iron, you're probably going to have indigestion a little bit later. And that's going to affect the way you feel a little bit later. If you go home after church and you say, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to go and I'm going to eat a bag of chips just to test that theory. Can I eat a bag of chips? Do I still have that ability? I'm going to tell you what I have a hard time learning. I've spent my entire life building an appetite and falling in love with delicious foods like pizza, hamburgers, and French fries. Brother Clifton, the one thing that I cannot eat anymore is hamburgers, pizza, French fries, for they do not settle well with me. But I think to myself, sometimes you just got to have it. You just have to bite the bullet and endure it. Even though I know where this is going to end, it's not going to end good, but maybe this time it ends better for me. Time after time after time, I find out that it ends exactly the way I thought it would end. Every moment in our life counts. We oftentimes, though, will think about the significant moments of our lives are those moments that we have been recognized or we received some sort of honor for. But I want you to rethink the way that we define those moments in life as a significant moment, because sometimes those moments go forgotten. Sometimes they are unforgotten and we're recognized, and sometimes they end up being forgotten. No one knows what it is that we are doing. No one knows, and no one sees, and no one recognizes, and no one will give you the attaboy or attagirl for what you have done. And if we're not careful, we'll get into this pattern of living where we will do what we know will draw the most attention so we can get the most accolades and receive honor. And we live our life for the spotlight because we want people to think about how great we are. But the measure of our character isn't necessarily seen in those great moments of life. Our character is displayed in those insignificant moments when no one's watching, where we have no audience. But do we have no audience? For God Himself knows exactly where we're at. Just because you can get by or you can get away with one moment, do not be so foolish as to presume through the arrogance of your pride that you can beat the system. No, don't think about the significant moments as the ones that are remembered or that you're exalted or honored for. Think about the significance and the significant moments as the ones that lead to another moment, another opportunity. If I get it right now, will I get it right tomorrow? If I get it right tomorrow, will I get it right the day after that? The significance of our decisions and the consequences of our choices diminish when we think to ourselves, you know what? I think right now I'm doing pretty good. I think right now I'm exactly where I need to be. And if that's where you're at, I say be careful, because you're setting yourself up to fall. A significant moment in life is one that's going to connect to another moment in life. And when you stop and look back at the small details of our life, the struggles that you and I have and will have tomorrow are going to be issues that we ignore in this moment right here and right now, as was demonstrated by our ignoring them in the past. Significance has nothing to do with the recognition and everything to do with the connection of where it takes us. So when we find ourselves in Esther chapter 6, let's begin reading in verse 1. On that night, could not the king sleep? And he commanded to bring the book of records to the chronicles. And they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains and the keepers of the door who sought to lay hand on King Ahasuerus. It's been a long time since we dealt with that little issue. Remember back at the very beginning, second week of our series, we saw that little detail about Mordecai stepping up and sending word that there was trouble coming for the king. The irony of Mordecai's actions in that moment. Do you know what the irony is? He saves the king's life, and he has not been recognized for it. That's the irony. You would think that if you were to take a bullet for the king or for the president, you would think that that you would be the one that would be recognized for the sacrifice. I think one of the hardest jobs in this world to have would be to be a Secret Service agent. That your purpose for protecting the president would be to take a bullet or to throw yourself in harm's way to protect his life. I think a little bit better about my life than that, to know that that's not my calling. To put myself in harm's way for someone else's sake. I know this is that point of the message where I get scolded because someone says, shame on you. You have a defense duty to protect your wife from small bugs that crawl across the floor or spiders. You should step up. I will step up and protect my household and my wife. But the problem with our leadership is sometimes we don't agree with where they're at or what they stand for. But the Secret Service agent doesn't have that license or that ability to say, you know what, that leader's not my political flavor, so I'm just going to step back here a while and let someone else step up. The whole purpose of the Secret Service agent is to put himself between harm and the president. And the irony of Mordecai's act, he is not recognized for what he has done for the king. Who should he be as king? I mean, he's a Hebrew. He's got a promised land promise waiting for him back in the Holy Land. And at this point of history, his people have been taken out of the promised land. They've been held in bondage in Babylon. Mordecai's making a life for himself in Persia. Wasn't supposed to be God's plan for his life, right? He's got the promised land, and here he is. He's got a significant place in the king's gate here in Shushan, and maybe he's getting comfortable with it. But we know that in the story, he's not comfortable where he's at because he knows that the outcome for his people and their days are numbered. And it's through this one moment that the king happens to have a sleepless night and he's having someone read to him. That is probably what we need in the middle of the night when you can't sleep. Don't pick up a book. Call someone and have them read to you. Maybe that will have them help you sleep. But just don't call me. Please don't. Now, the king asks a very important question here. It's ironic. What honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai? What in the world have we done in the kingdom to recognize Mordecai for his actions towards me? It's ironic that the king is expecting someone else to have this answer for him. Look with me at verse 3. And the king said, what honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, there is nothing done for him. And the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman was come into the courtyard of the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servants said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court. And the king said, let him come in. And the irony of Haman's honor, the irony of that moment, that the king is troubled, he can't sleep, and he's having someone read about some ancient or some past news. And it just happens to be that Haman is so troubled at his wife's request, he's gone to the king to request that he be allowed to hang Mordecai on his gallows. That's what he's gone for. Notice the irony of what ends up happening in verse 6. So Haman came in, and the king said unto him, who shall be done unto this man whom the kings delighted to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? Do you see the pride in Haman's assessment of the king's question. Who else in the kingdom deserves to be honored but me? And he is so filled with rage against Mordecai that he believes in these next few moments that the king is going to give him an opportunity to exalt himself before all of the kingdom. And Haman answers in verse 7, "For the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let royal apparel be brought, which the king used to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head." And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delighteth to honor." Verse 7. We have a problem here. The irony is that the wrong man is going to be honored. The problem with his request of the royal apparel, which the king used to wear. You know, give me, he's thinking to himself, dress me the way you dress, and put me on your horse. Oh, and the crown, put the crown on my head, and let the apparel and the horse be delivered to the hand of the one who of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with whom the king delighteth to honor. King, take someone of great importance and have them dress me. This is what he's thinking. This is his motivation. Have them dress me, set me on horseback, and then have that prince bring on horseback through the street of the city to proclaim before him, "Thus it shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor." Oh, what a scheme in Haman's heart to set up his own honor. It's oftentimes, you know, whenever it's time for a birthday present and someone says, "What would you like for your birthday?" And you don't hold back. You ask for everything on your wish list, everything on your punch list. That's what Haman has just done. And we find in verse 10, the king says unto Haman, "Make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail that all thou hast spoken." And right there in that moment, for Haman, the irony is everything that he asked for was to be done unto Mordecai. Remember, Mordecai is sitting in the gate. He's ripped his clothes and he's sitting in a place of mourning because he knows that his days are numbered and his end is certain. And it seems to be that unless Esther's plan works, if you're an outside observer, if you listen to what Mordecai's plan be delivered, it's going to come in and rescue his people, even if it costs him his life. He's sitting in the gate mourning, and he's going to go from mourning to exaltation. And it's not going to be just that his circumstance changed, but the very man who is hastening his end is going to be the one whose hand will lead him through the city and make the decree to see what happens to the one in whom the king finds pleasure. The irony of Mordecai's honor we see in verse 11. Then Haman took the apparel and the horse, and he arrayed Mordecai and brought him on horseback through the street of the city and proclaimed it before him, "Thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor." Can you imagine what type of a job Haman did in that moment? Knowing that it was supposed to be him on the horse. Knowing that he was supposed to be crowned the homecoming king. He was the one that was supposed to be recognized. He's the one who's walking in front of the horse and shouting out for everyone to look unto Mordecai, for whom the king has remembered his act of faithfulness and his act of honor. And Haman is the one who was abased and brought low. And it was his pride that led Mordecai's honor. He was probably not in a great heart place. He was probably definitely leading Mordecai with a heart of contempt. Every time he had to open his mouth and make that decree, you could almost hear his thoughts and his intents. This was supposed to be me. This is not the way it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be me that is exalted. Verse 12, and Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hastened to his house mourning and having his head covered. See the shift, the switch, the irony of the situation. The one who is low has been exalted. The one who is high has been brought down. But it's the irony of Zeresh's perspective that we end. And we see that for Haman, this does not end well. Verse 13, and Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had been done before him. Then said his wife, his wise men, and Zereth, his wife, unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shall surely fall before him. And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hastened to bring Haman into the banquet that Esther had prepared. Remember, he was on top. He had a private audience with the king and the queen. And having just had to lead Mordecai through the city gates and hearing his wife's perspective, oh, this is not going to end good. Last week we saw her telling him, hey, build that gallows 75 feet high. But today, she can read the situation clearly. This is not going to end well for you. When we look at his sense of pride, we see the fallacy that sometimes draws us in or drives us to elevate ourselves, to pump up ourselves, to exalt ourselves. But we realize, and we need to realize from Esther chapter 6, that pride ends the same way for everyone, every time. And that's not a statement of irony. That's a statement of reality. Irony is thinking that it will end differently. Our first point, pride assures you that you deserve more. That's what drives us. We're not talking here about the desire to give your best, to give more of yourself, to better your circumstance, to work harder. We're not talking about that. That's connected with your character. Your character is what will drive you to do what is right in right situations, when everyone's looking and when no one is looking. It's what will keep you from starting when no one's looking. No, pride assures you that you deserve more and that someone else should be willing to sacrifice, should be willing to give you exactly what you want because you deserve it. Proverbs 16, verses 18 through 19. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Better is to be of the humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. If there were ever a scripture that were prophetic for Haman's situation, pride goeth before the destruction. And I don't want to ruin the sense of irony as to where the story's headed, but you probably know what happens with Haman. Pride assures us that we deserve more. But scriptures and Solomon's insight was clear. It's better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. Why? Because we get that sense of, you know what? Look at everything that I've got. Look at this kingdom that I've built. Look at everything that I've gathered. I have protected myself and I have insulated myself. And I have set myself with a little kingdom here that no one can touch me. And Haman did exactly the same thing. He thought that he was untouchable, and he thought that he was the only way to exalt him was to give him exactly what he wanted, and in truth, he was giving his greatest enemy exactly what he thought himself deserved, and he's brought to that place lowly. Secondly, pride assures will lead you away from God. 2 Corinthians 10, 17 through 18. But he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. For not he that commendeth himself is approved, but whom the Lord commendeth. Oftentimes, it's really easy to recognize someone, to throw your weight behind someone because of their confidence, because of their sense of pride. We will fall behind a strong leader because he projects himself. He projects that image of being a man of greatness. If you listen to what the man says, it will stir you up and it will excite you. But as you watch him, you'll start to see the cracks in his armor. Given enough time, we began to see some inconsistencies in his character and how you and I define greatness. How would we define greatness today? By how much money someone has in the bank? They love stuff more than they love God. Is the struggle that I see in my life. The struggle that I have with my resources. And I know it can't be any different for you. That if God could just give me a little bit more, I would be better off where I wouldn't have to trust in him as much as the temptation that sin tries to sell you. And I know sometimes that's hard. We're willing to make concessions. Well, I need to get ahead, so I'll do this. And it may mean a sacrifice of my character. It may mean a sacrifice in order to get ahead, but it's worth the cost. And little by little, we trade away our good name and our honor for fulfilling our pride. Life would get a little bit easier, is the promise. No, you and I do not use the right criteria to define greatness. It's the Lord. It's the Lord who remembers. It's the Lord who brings honor. It is the Lord who is the greatest, and there is none greater. And it's what he thinks of me that matters more than what you think of me. But pride will say, well, he's not here, he's not looking, but everyone else is. So be what they want you to be. Act the way they want you to act. Fit in and be successful. Stand up and stand out. Stand proud. But pride is dangerous because it turns on us. And the one thing that we are trying to do in order to make life a little bit easier, to get ahead, to get a little bit of recognition, just to get everything that we want, to have all of our wildest dreams fulfilled, the tragedy is that it pulls us away from serving God, walking with God, loving God. Because we find ourselves before too long too busy, too concerned with what people think, too busy, too driven to satisfy a crowd than to realize our accountability before the holy God who is watching. Even though we can't see him, he knows exactly where we're at. He knows exactly what we're in need of. And Mordecai is receiving the hand of God's blessing on his life in this moment of exaltation. And God is bringing down Haman in that moment. Pride, I'm going to define, as something that pulls you away from God. That's what it does. Because it exalts me at the expense of God's prominence in my life. I deserve better than this. I shouldn't have to put up with that. Pride will also prevent you from seeing the significance of a moment. In Philippians 2, verses 4 through 6, Paul writes of Jesus' heart, "Look, not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of other. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God." Remember moments ago when we talked about the significant moments of life? And I said it's more than just those really, really big moments. It's those moments that affect our step and our journey in a relationship with Christ. If it's pulling you away from him, it can't be good for you if it's driving you to the altar, crying out to him. Then I think we need to look at the heart of Jesus and see Paul's instructions here. Jesus didn't think it robbery to be equal with God. He says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God." The next verse, he humbles himself. In obedience, he went to the cross for you and for me. And the lie that pride will sell us is that you and I are good enough on our own. But the significance of the moment And seeing that is the one who's going to draw you to be more like Jesus. And I think that's a great way to look at the criteria of a circumstance or decision. We don't always have the foresight to know the consequences of our choices. But you don't understand, this is what I want to do, this is what I've got to do. You're going to have to let me make this decision for myself and let me fall and learn the hard way. But it doesn't have to be that way. Because life presents us with so many opportunities to run from Jesus, when all the while it should be driving us to His feet. The significance of the moment is the one that draws you to be more like Jesus. That's how you come out on top. And the fourth point, we're done. Pride will keep you from the altar. Psalm 10, verse 4. The wicked, through pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not at all in his thoughts. And it doesn't take David's song to point out the rather obvious observation that what's at play in driving us in our pride is not a fervent desire for the Lord, but rather a fervent desire to see ourselves exalted. And the furthest thing from our heart is what it's going to cost me, what it's going to do in my relationship with Christ. And I hope that you see, and in these last few moments, the importance and the significance of those teeny, tiny, small moments. For every moment of life presents us with the same challenge and the same opportunity for those who knew Christ and for those who follow Him day by day. Lord, do I continue to serve You, or do I seek after what the world tells me will bring me more satisfaction? Do I continue to serve You even though it may be more hard, more challenging, it will cost me more? Or do I take the easy way out and buy into the lie that sin and pride always try to sell, to receive the payout that I can never, ever receive? Because the irony of pride and the irony of sin is that you learn exactly who you are and what you have need of. That it didn't satisfy. That it didn't mean enough to me to be recognized, to be exalted. For in the end, I see my downfall was choosing my pride over choosing Christ. No, come back next week. We'll see Haman learn the lesson that pride will leave you hanging all alone. Here's our response. There is no honor in pride. And so in these next few moments, I'm going to invite you to search yourself before you question God. And that's oftentimes where we are headed when we start to question God. Doubt, our unbelief, our hopelessness, all stem from how we define that moment. God, I deserve better than this. You shouldn't leave me here in this moment. I'm going to have to act because I don't see You acting. Before we question God's goodness, we need to question the goodness and motivations of our heart. And I think a lot of times, oftentimes, every time, I see the root behind our humanity, the root of our sin is our prideful desire to go after that which looks good. That's going to give the great payout to know more, to make us wiser and make us more satisfied. We need to question ourselves before we question God's goodness. And we come to Him trusting that He is good. I am amazed at the story of Esther, how I do not see his name written, printed in the text. Though I understand in the Old Testament, the Jews so revered the Lord that they would not print his name, but rather they would leave the tetragrammaton to show his name as a placeholder because they respected his name so great. But when we look at the story of Esther, we see that in this story, God's hand is at work protecting his people, providing exactly the promise that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that he's a God who does not forget, and that he is good. And if life doesn't present you with the opportunity to see his goodness, I ask you to question your pride as being what blocks you from seeing God's goodness in the moment, in the situation. And then after that, look for his hand of blessing, of provision, of comfort, of care, for He is there and He is here. And in this moment, as we close, may this be our prayer. Jesus, I surrender my selfish pride to You.